Hi, everyone. So I'm going to start with dark matter, another form of matter that we think is out there in the universe. It's about 100 years ago that the story begins, and astronomers were looking out into the night sky and seeing something very odd. And that was that stars on the edges of galaxies were just whizzing around way too fast, right? It's as if you have a conker on a string and you're spinning this around at like a million miles an hour. The string should break. The conker should fly off, right? Galaxies should not be holding themselves together in the way they are. But here we are. You know, without some additional glue, some additional source of gravity, nothing makes sense. Our sort of, you know, the equations, we're, you know, throwing all this gravity and things into our equations, trying to understand what's moving and what's going on out there. And it's like, no, this doesn't work. It turns out that everything that we see, everything that we're made of, stars, including black holes, all that kind of jazz, everything, is only about 4% of the universe. A whopping 96% of it is dark, in that we don't know what it is. And it's a code word for, and so most of that stuff, about 70%, is dark energy, and that is response to the universe is expanding, but it seems to be getting faster and faster and faster, just accelerating. This expansion is getting faster and faster. We don't know why. It's like this sort of anti-gravity. But 30% of the universe seems to be matter, or at least it has a gravitational influence on us, on the stuff that we're made of. So what is it? What is it? We think it looks something like this. So you're looking at incredibly large scales here, like each of the little dots in there are clusters of many, you know, hundreds of galaxies. And this purple stuff sort of holds it all together. It's a beautiful image. You know, and these are simulations where you find that, you know, if you run the simulations without this stuff, galaxies don't form. They start to form and then they spin up and then off they go. And you put this stuff in and, you know, we get simulation outputs that are very similar to real life. But again, we don't know what it is. We don't know for sure that it's stuff, but our best guesses at the moment say, yeah, probably stuff. We'll do a bit of audience participation. You're all going to be dark matter detectors. So the theory is that we've got dark matter streaming through us all the time. It's all around us. It's sort of, you know, it goes out 10 times. If you imagine, you know, our visible galaxy, the Milky Way being this, then dark matter is this envelope that goes out 10 times. Further in diameter, and it's everywhere, and it's moving through us all the time. And so what I try and do with, you know, many thousands of colleagues all over the world is try and understand what dark matter is, find it, detect it, and try and sort of say, okay, we think we know what this stuff is. But for now, just to illustrate how the challenge, we'll do a bit of an experiment. We're going to try and catch a dark matter particle flying through us right now. So if you hold a finger up, and what you're going to look for, pay close attention, a lot of attention here. What you're looking for is a dark matter particle. There's 100,000 of them, we think, going through your fingertip every second. One of them may just bump into an atom, but what it's going to do is it's going to hit the nucleus of a single atom, and it's going to kick it, it's going to give it a tiny bump, and that single nucleus of a single atom is going to move about a thousandth of a hair's width. Okay, so that's what we're trying to pay attention to. And you'll need to hold your finger up for about 7,000 years to have any kind of chance of this, right? So let's not do it that way. Let's try something else. So instead, we go a mile under the Black Hills of South Dakota. So there's a former gold mine there that has been sort of turned into a national laboratory for underground science. And instead, you can build, you know, large detectors. So this is some images of the Lux Zeppelin detector. This is, you know, the world's most sensitive dark matter detector. That's sort of code for saying we're the best at not finding dark matter. These are large detectors, and we've been working for decades to kind of get to this sort of scale. And maybe if dark matter is what we think it is, a kind of almost like the easiest solution would be this large particle created in the Big Bang that is floating around, that's going through our finger, you know, 100,000 of them. And by the way, I didn't say they're going through about 500,000 miles an hour. And so we can try, you know, we can build a big detector and see if we can catch some of these or see them interact. Or they may be much, much, much smaller. So the dark matter problem, or the solution to the dark matter problem, if it's a particle, is such that it could be something like a small black hole, all the way down to a particle, you know, of the mass of a hydrogen atom, to something a millionth of the mass of a hydrogen atom. So it's crazy, right? It's like saying we're trying to find a needle in a haystack would be easy. What we're trying to find is a needle that could be anything from, you know, the size of an elephant to you know, a pin in a haystack that we don't know. There's lots of unknowns here, is the point. So we also use quantum sensors. So what you're looking at here is a nanoparticle levitated by optomechanically, sort of held by lasers, and it's super sensitive to anything interacting with it. So if dark matter's out there and it's very, very light, then these big underground detectors won't be able to catch it, but something like this might. And so there's lots and lots of effort all around the world trying to understand or directly detect dark matter. But now we're gonna get a bit esoteric. So what are we actually doing? There are four fundamental forces that we understand at the moment. There's one that's gravity, and that's sort of in the realm of Einstein and general relativity and, you know, warp space-time and things like that. And then there's the weak nuclear force, a strong nuclear force, and electromagnetism. They're all quantum field theories. That's all quantum mechanics. So the way our phones work, all that kind of stuff, right? That's all quantum mechanics. And the space-time, the kind of space we inhabit, that's all general relativity. And what we've done with dark matter is say, oh, wow, we've got this gravitational problem, sort of general relativity problem. Huh, particle? Let's go to quantum field theory, right? And let's say, well, let's go look for a particle, because it's been very successful in the past. We found particles when we've, you know, looked for them. But none of them have involved gravity before. So there's a bit of a sort of, you know, an assumption that's going on with this game. And so what I want to draw your attention to is this split. General relativity, the sort of worldview of, you know, space-time, and then quantum mechanics. What that leads to in terms of sociological sort of thinking and some of the cosmologies and some of the way, you know, physicists and scientists think, is that we're particles, or there are particles moving around in space-time. That's certainly how it looks, right? But we don't know how quantum mechanics and general relativity mesh. Another way of saying that is that we don't really know what stands under them, right? There's something going on. There's a process of universe that is happening all the time, or all the non-time, and what it generates, what it creates, is, at least the way it appears to us, is that there's stuff in non-stuff. But that's not true, right? It just seems that way. Similarly, we can draw on sort of very old experiments like wave-particle duality, and that's to say that if you look for if you want to sort of have a look at what an electron is, for example, and you set up an experiment to say, look, I think this is actually more like a wave rather than a discrete thing like a particle. You set your experiment up that way, and yeah, it looks like a wave. But then somebody else comes along and says, well, I think it's a particle, let's set it up like a particle, and it looks like a particle. And so we've just called it wave-particle duality. It's like this, you know, it's all schizophrenic, it's fine, it's all right. We can do, you know, we can do the maths either way. And then the third example is like energy and matter, right? So this famous equation E equals mc squared. What is it actually saying? Right? It's saying that matter is energy slowed down, right? And matter and energy, you can flick between them any way you like with this conversion of c squared. It's like pounds equals dollars times 0.9. You can go between any way you like, right? It's fine. But the point is that these are both expressions of currency. What is energy and matter an expression of? Neither energy nor matter, right? These are sort of representations of something that is not a thing or a no thing. And that's kind of the same thing, right? Wave-particle duality is sort of telling us about two modes of expression, as is general relativity and quantum mechanics, two modes of something else, of the process of universe that seems very static to us. So is this something to do with the way we process things? Is this, you know, if you think of, you know, the different size of the brain and things like that, there are, you know, crudely speaking, obviously it's not quite as cut as and dry as that, but, you know, there's regions where we might, when we sort of perceive or sense our surroundings or universe or, in, you know, internal systems, it feels very connected, very, you know, one, right? And that's very much like the waves or the general relativity view and things like that, or the E in E equals MC squared. But then you've got parts of the brain that will say, I don't know, let's zoom in, right? Let's smash things apart and get smaller and smaller and smaller and find the particulate sort of, you know, answer to this stuff, which is the matter or the particle or, you know, the quantum field, you know, what that's dealing with. And they both seem to be valid, but are they really telling us about what's actual or just some psychological reality? You know, what's actually going on here? And is this inhibiting our progress, right, in actually trying to understand these problems and get a bit deeper into them? Because it seems to be that they can, this type of thinking or going about working in this way leads to a certain view, right, of us being in the universe. So if I ask, you know, am I in the universe? And are you in the universe? If we think of a, you know, let's take a cup of coffee or a glass of water and I drop a stone in it, the water is displaced by the stone. That water level rises. I hope you'd all agree. By me being here in the universe, have I displaced it? By you being here in the universe, have you displaced it? No, right? That's absurd. You're it. You're part of the process of the universe. So right here, right now, universe here is being a lectern. Universe there is being you, and universe there is being you, and universe here in this space and time in these dimensions is being me, right? It's not that I come from outside the universe and then inhabit this alien world where I need to feel, you know, where I need to buy into the scarcity myth, or I'm this lonely person on a dark rock randomly created in this empty cosmos. It's just not true. There's no physics, there's no cosmology that supports that. There's lots of economic models and things like that that support it because, you know, hey, feel alone, go buy a bigger TV or something like that. But it's not true, right? I'm not in the universe. I am the universe, just as you are, right? We're all just different aspects of it. But quite literally, I mean this quite literally, right? We don't come from somewhere else into the universe to visit. But if you think that way, if you do think that we're particles in space, almost as if energy creates matter. If you put all this stuff into some linearized form, then it does start to seem that way. And certainly a lot of, you know, when we inhabit the world and we move around, it does feel that way. It can feel like, you know, with these lonely things trying to connect with each other on this lonely rock. But that might be because of something to do with the way we're thinking and the way that we're processing our thought, because it ends up leading to us othering pretty severely, othering the Earth. You know, we've heard in, you know, some of the earlier talks, we are the very stuff that makes up the cosmos, the Earth, everything, right? I've got the same amount of hydrogen and lithium and everything else as the rest of the Earth. I'm made of it. But if I think that I'm not, then it's easy for me to dig it up, right? And take oil and kill people and do sorts of other stuff, right? Essentially other, because really I've othered myself from my own universe, which is kind of bonkers. But then, you know, the way we behave, if you think of all the nuclear bombs that we've pointed at our own Earth, it's bonkers. It's absolutely nuts. So what? Another way that this plays out, speaking about bonkers, is that if you've got this kind of split of one view and another view, and then I'm going to frame this in kind of, you know, physics language, I'll just do it. If you've got these two systems that can only really say, well, I'm going a bit left, well, I'm going more right, well, I'm going more left to compensate, well, I'm going more right, you'll split up the middle or you'll get some centrist that pulls it back in. But as time's progressing, you're just doing this. It's going in a straight line because you can't do anything else. And in a three-dimensional geometry, that's a circle. It means you're just going round and round and round, right? The times will change and it will look different, but it's a circular system because we're not coming to what's common, right? If this lot started talking about their common humanity, compassion, anything like that, right, it'd be game-changing. But currently, we don't have that. And we don't have it in quantum mechanics and general relativity. We don't have it in any of these fields. How do we go about dealing with that, right? There are a few ways, you know, there's many ways that we can do this. I, you know, my own experience and what I've been learning is that meditation is pretty profound because it can bring you out of certain regions of thinking. That sort of perpetuate this. You know, it's like we've got stuck in a type of thought and we're finding it very hard to get out of it, or maybe don't want to get out of it. But it is perpetuating a worldview or cosmos view that isn't true, right? Isn't based in science, isn't based in anything. And it's also leading to a lot of destruction and a lot of suffering. And I think we're kind of ripe, right? We're starting to move out of it. So this image was supposed to represent two things. One is plant medicine and the other is meditation. Both of them can do phenomenal things, right, for releasing rarefied ideas. You know, it's like we're trying to understand something, but I'm not going to let go of this rung of the ladder because I'm right. Well, then you're never going to move up, right? You're not going to understand anymore. And so ways to kind of dissipate that, you know, there are techniques that we could be doing. It doesn't involve buying a bigger TV, then, right? So it's not pushed. So I'll leave you with this, which I think is, you know, if I'd taken away Einstein and, you know, his name and everything, and said, who said this? If you've not heard this before, a lot of people say, I don't know, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, but a human being is a part of the whole called by us universe, called by us universe. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion, to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. I absolutely love that, because I think he's spot on. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much.